And welcome to another episode of GT Radio. And tonight I have a very, very great guest. His name is Matt Olin, CEO of Apache Gaming Enterprises. Hello, Matt. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks.
Really, really happy that you're able to come on the show tonight. Before the show, we were talking a little bit about emails and communication with your team, and you were telling me that you're able to do a lot remotely with your team. Tell me a little bit about the team and how important that is to doing what you do and making things run the way that they run.
Well, you know, that's a great question. You know, especially when you find yourself in today's environment where you're dealing with multiple appointments, meetings, emails, and I think, as I mentioned to you just before we came on, I'm averaging about 300 emails a day and, you know, trying to work our way through it. And then, you know, if you have multiple properties like we do, that's always a challenge too. So we've really gotten to the point where, you know, we're able to work pretty much remotely from wherever we need to. It's VPN. We can remote in. I can log into my work computer from here. I have an office at Apache Gold. I have an office at Apache Sky. And, we're just able to maintain just constant communication. And, man, technology is amazing these days, you know. But also, as I said, yeah, when it comes to gaming and guest service and working with team members and employees and presence on the gaming floor, that's the one thing you can't replace. So that is one thing you being present is critical. But in terms of being able to accomplish work, man, I can get more done some days from my home office than I can, you know, from any other office. So that's pretty amazing. It's great technology.
Now,
I think when we were talking earlier, you said you used to keep a bag of quarters for a payphone.
Yeah, that's right. So exactly. Back in the day when I was in the movie business in the 80s, and I think this was even before pagers. I don't know if you remember the pagers. You used to get a beep and then you'd call in. Yeah. Well, I used to be on the road and I'd have to pull over to a phone booth and, you know, return my calls if it was something that needed attending, you know. So I'd be in a phone booth for like an hour returning calls with putting quarters in. But that's all changed. Tell me a little bit about the importance of being on the floor and in touch with what's going on at the casino. How is that so important to your job?
Well, you know, I mean, it's really vital. It's really the thing that keeps you in touch with most importantly of all, of course, are your guests. Spending time walking the floor, getting to know all of your guests, certainly, of course, all your high-value gamers on a personal level, but all gamers, just, you know, it's important, that interaction. You know, one of the things, we have a guest service program, and I have had anywhere I go, and I'll steal a line from Steve at Raving. He mastered it, so I can't claim it for myself, but I always say it when I introduce myself that our guest service program is above and beyond. And I always, you know, my introduction is, what do we sell in the gaming business? And, of course, a lot of people say, well, winning and different things like that. And you know, the response is, well, what we sell is an experience. And that experience is the gaming experience. So it's got peaks, it's got valleys, it's got ups and downs. And at the end of the day, it's about your guests coming in and interacting personally with all of the team members. And that includes, it must include the CEO, who is on the floor interacting and shaking hands and talking to our guests. And the gaming industry as it exists today really is a guest experience. And I'm sure later on in the conversation we'll go where we think the industry is headed. But for today, the baby boomers are what built this growth in gaming, and they, one of the main reasons they come to the casino is to not just gamble, but to interact with team members and other guests. That's what they do.
Yeah, it's almost like it's a part of their home, part of the way they go
and see
their friends.
Yeah.
It's an extension of it.
Let me tell you, I've been in the business almost 30 years, and yeah, I can't tell you just how many weddings, bar mitzvahs, and funerals, and you name it, that I've been to of our guests, because you know that's what we're there to do. We're there to get to know them and interact, and it means a lot to them.
Yeah, and you know, from the sounds of it, you run a very personable staff, so that's pretty important. Tell me a little bit about your background, where you're born, your parents. Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. I'm dating myself a bit, so I won't tell you when I'm born. I'll just tell you where. So I was born in Boulder, Colorado. Spent a good part of my childhood there. My father was an attorney, and he was actually, during the time that I was there, he was associate dean and then dean for a brief period of time at the University of Colorado Law School. And I was there until, you know, middle school or so, and then ended up moving to Southern Colorado, and sort of grew up in a small town in Southern Colorado, and ended up going to college at the University of Southern Colorado, and then back to Boulder, where I went to the University of Colorado at CU campus.
Oh, that's great. And, you know, what kind of things were you into as a kid?
Well, I was active. So I was involved in sports. Probably, you know, my passion has been martial arts. So, heck, I don't remember when. I'd say in my early teens I got involved in Shotokan. With an individual in that small town that I grew up in who was a master in Shotokan, and he took me all the way through my black belt, and then as I sort of moved on into different places, I ended up also getting a black belt in Kenpo, and then ultimately a black belt in Taekwondo. And my sensei, who awarded me my black belt in Taekwondo, was Master Kim, who was the sensei for the world Taekwondo headquarters. So that was pretty amazing to be able to train under him. But also in high school, I was involved in a lot of sports, and actually ended up going to college on athletic scholarships and track and other activities like that.
So. Yeah, pretty amazing. So competition is in your blood.
Yeah, I was born with it, man. When it's in your blood, you just got to do it.
You got to know. Yeah, the great, great background in the arts. I love the arts too. Love Bruce Lee. Did you have any idea what you would do with your life? You know, when you were growing up, did you have any inkling that you would be in the business? And I know you had some early, early experiences.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I'd say I'm like, you know, 99% of anyone who has no clue what they're going to do when they grow up. So, you know, it seems to me your first reaction is to turn toward what people do around you that's familiar. And in my case, my dad was a pretty accomplished attorney, and my mom was a professor at the university, and so my inkling was to pursue my law degree, and but I had a lot of experience in hospitality. I ended actually I started in the hospitality business in the food and beverage industry when I was 12 years old. I'm sure I'll bore your audience, but when I was 12, I got a job at a local restaurant peeling potatoes. And by the time I was 21, amazingly, I owned and operated that restaurant. And so I loved
Wow.
food and beverage. It was just, you know, the luck of the draw. It was a really nice steakhouse and loved doing it. You know, it was just, I worked the line and, you know, just did all the prep work. So it was kind of interesting. But my goal at that time was law school. And my dad, I don't know why, but he said, nah, they're turning out attorneys a dime a dozen. You don't want to do that. Go into something else. And so
wow.
I ended up getting into gaming just by chance, just by investment, which I'll fill you in here in just a bit. But it ended up that I was an investor in different types of businesses, and we ended up investing in small town buildings in the rural communities of Colorado, and got involved in that whole constitutional amendment. But
wow, that's incredible.
But never thought
that's cool.
Never thought I'd be in gaming.
How did it all happen?
Well, you know, again, I was, as I think I explained, I was kind of in the hospitality business, also kind of a young entrepreneur. With family, we owned some construction businesses and a few other things. And we'd ended up, again, with family initially, with ownership in Central City, Colorado. And in the late 80s, probably most people on the phone will have no clue what I'm talking about, but in the late 80s, there was an initiative in Colorado to do something very similar to what had happened in North Dakota in terms of limited stakes gaming. And folks in Central City, Colorado, and Cripple Creek, Colorado, were passing around petitions to amend the state constitution to allow limited stakes gaming. And I was a big part of that, got deeply involved in it. And we ended up investing and raising money to get signatures on a petition to amend the state's constitution. We're actually fortunately successful at it. But one kind of funny story, and I'll keep it brief, but the Cripple Creek group that was circulating petitions and the Central City group both were spending pretty much all the money they had, and we'd all kind of run out of money and we weren't quite there yet. So we all got together and said, well, we need about $5,000 to bring this thing home and to get it out to the ballot. And, you know, we all talked and thought for a bit, and we said, you know, the only person I know who's got $5,000 to spare is the owner of the Black Forest Inn down in Blackhawk. And so we went down and met with the owner, and he said, yeah, I'll put it up. He said, but you got to include Blackhawk in the gaming district. Now, I don't know how many people are familiar with the Colorado area, but now Blackhawk dominates everything. And at the time, Blackhawk was just something you drove through on your way to Central City. But so we got it on
wow.
the ballot, and yeah, and we got it passed. And we then with partners, we owned and operated three casinos in Colorado, the first of which opened on October 1st, 1991, opening day. We were the third casino in the state to open.
Wow. Tell us a little bit of what it was like back then to be involved in something like that.
You know, it was amazing. I again, I was a kid. I was, heck, in my late 20s and brand new to the industry and you know, fortunate enough and blessed enough to be a partner and an owner in our first casino was fairly small. But I didn't know anything about gaming. So I was smart enough to find, me with family and other investors, found partners who knew a little something about gaming. And then I spent my first about year and a half or so just learning the business. I actually, and it was probably the funnest time I've ever had. I literally worked every single job in the casino, whether it was dealing or cage or count and drop or bartending or housekeeping. I worked every job for 2 or 3 months just to learn it from the ground up. And that's how I broke into the business, just learning what I was doing there. And we ultimately ended up opening the second larger casino also in Central City. And I had the first option to purchase a spot of land that is now the Lodge Casino in Blackhawk, but I ended up in a conflict with my partners, and we ended up opening one in Cripple Creek. So I lost my option, unfortunately. I wish I still had that one back. But we opened the one in Cripple Creek, and in 1993, we took that public on NASDAQ. And did quite well, trading at 20 times earnings, and ended up in a reverse triangular mortgage with, reverse triangular merger with Century Casinos. And they ended up buying out that property, and Century's still there. It's now Legends Womax, and they're still trading on NASDAQ, believe it or not. In fact, When we merged with Century in 1994, we were trading at $2.50 a share, and now they're trading, I think their symbol is CNTY, they're trading at $8 a share.
Wow. Pretty incredible. What a story. Tell me, Matt, a little bit about what were the hardest things that you had to get through, you know, when you started learning the casino business, because you came at it in a very different way. You actually were involved in building some of the first casinos in the state. What was that like? What were some of the hardest things that you had to get through?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it I've already kind of described is a lot of the hardest part was the fact that we were really pioneers. And at that time, even though it was the, you know, sort of beginning to be post-IGRA, there really weren't a lot of states that had gaming. I mean, Nevada did, and New Jersey, and then there was limited stakes in, you know, North Dakota, and now, of course, in Colorado and some of the other ones. So, obviously, the hardest thing is learning the business. But even before then, being kind of a young entrepreneur breaking into the business, we were expanding quickly, and we formed a LLC and a couple of C corps. And so the probably the biggest part was initially, developing, designing, and then more importantly, financing in this sort of, at that time, new market, high risk, opening casinos. So from 1990 to 1993, my primary function was to finance, develop, build, and open three different casinos. But then I think in addition to that, I had to learn the industry from the ground up. So that was a challenge. And I think, as I told you, the way I did that was I just forced myself to literally walk a mile in the shoes of all of the team members, understand what they did every day, so I could, really understand, not only the business from the ground up, but, how best to run and manage the business. So that's been a challenge. But then, as we know, it never ends. So,
yeah.
Over the last almost 30 years, you have to stay in touch with, professional development and best practices and what's happening in the industry and the newest trends. Even today, new trends in sports betting, mobile betting, intranet, competitive esports, analytics, So the challenge never ends. And
yeah, it always continues on. Yeah.
That's it.
Now, you had a relationship with working with George Maloof. Can you tell us a little bit about how that happened, and also tell us a little bit about the man himself?
Yes. Again, back in those early days in Central City, the Maloof family came from New Mexico, and you may or may not know, they had not gotten into the gaming business until they entered the business in Colorado. And their first casino that they opened was in Central City, Colorado, just down the street from the two that we owned. And so George and I kind of became friends and sort of peers. And I can't state claim that I taught him much about the business, but I helped him open his first casino and, you know, kind of showed him what we did. And so after we sold our casinos, I took, you know, a few days off, as in a year or so. And George called me one day and said, "Hey, would you come up and run our casino in Colorado? We're out at Fiesta and kind of focusing on that." So I had, you know, the opportunity to spend some time working for George there, and then subsequently ended up going out to Fiesta and helping build the Palms. But in terms of George himself, brilliant guy, great entrepreneur, loved working with him. It was interesting in the days when I was in Colorado, because he'd call from Fiesta. We'd have a call once a week. And George is an interesting guy in terms of a boss, because one, we had kind of been peers, and so we had a lot of mutual respect, but, you know, he was still my boss. So we had an arrangement where we'd have a phone call every Thursday, and he'd call, and we'd go through the numbers and how the business was doing. And it was so funny, because George would be, you know, just abrupt, and, you know, this is terrible, and these numbers are awful, and what are you doing? And, you know, what the heck's going on out there? And, it was pretty rough, 5 or 10 minute call. And it was always so funny, because at the end of the call, he'd say, "Okay, Matt, well, you're doing a great job. Thanks." But, great guy to work for.
It's a great story.
Yeah, man.
I love that one.
He was funny. So,
and he did that all the time, right?
Every Tuesday. Every Tuesday
every
afternoon
Tuesday.
We had that call.
Well, you know what that's called? It's called the Harvard School of Business. So
that there you go.
It's,
there you go.
It, a lot of people didn't go to Harvard, but the people who were very successful, they used that that methodology. And my father was like that, too. He'd never give me a compliment. And then at the end, he'd go, "Yeah, but you did a pretty good job. But, you know, it's not that great."
Okay. Yeah, that's yours.
Because he always wanted you to do better, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I don't care how good you're doing, you can do better. But,
yeah,
great,
yeah, it's never good enough.
And an entrepreneur. And, you know, what he did with the Palms was it's fascinating. When I ended up out there at the Fiesta, he brought me out to run Fiesta, because he was going to take Ed over to the Palms, Ed Fasulo. And I remember in the early days, we were all part of the team that built the Palms, and George shared his concept of how he was going to put it, you know, right there across from the Rio, and he was going to get 50% local and 50% strip. And he was going to dominate that market. And I remember arguing with him, saying, "George, Rio's already got that market cornered. You don't have a chance. You're crazy. I don't know why you're doing this." And he proved me wrong in every way you could be proven wrong, right? I mean, the Palms became such a huge success, and I credit the man. He had a degree of genius.
Yeah, yeah. And I still think the numbers are still like that. I think during the day it's the locals' place, and then at night it becomes like a strip place. So that hasn't changed.
Yeah, yeah, amazing.
Really hasn't changed. Pretty incredible. Tell me a little bit about what you think were the forces that happened when the crash happened in 08 and kind of broke that whole thing up. What happened there?
Well, you know, I mean, of course, we all felt 08. So, I mean, the first thing that happened was 08, you know, I mean. And up until 08, all of us in the gaming business thought that, you know, whether we were in, you know, growth markets or depression markets, we all believed that it never really affected gaming because they never seemed to in the past. But 2008 was different. And, you know, the impacts on gaming were, you know, devastating. And it really hit Vegas and it really hit the Palms and a lot of other properties. And, you know, sort of back to George, they, you know, they, of course, went from a, you know, majority interest in the Palms and a controlling and management lead in the Palms. And pretty much got down to essentially nothing. And you know, they were terribly impacted. And I think for them, it was a combination, of course, without a doubt, 2008. But I think also they, you know, and a lot of other casinos in Vegas at the time did this too. They got caught up in having too many partners, being over leveraged. They just, you know, invested too much money in that second hotel tower. And, you know, the combination between, you know, too much debt and too rapid an expansion and, you know, over leveraging really was sort of the downfall of the Malus, you know, sort of domination with the Palms. Of course, Palms survived, just as did Stations, even though unfortunately all the Stations investors got crushed. You know, Frank and Lorenzo ended up fortunately coming out all right at the end, I guess, but same kind of thing, just rapid expansion and too much debt.
Yep, yeah, just the luck of the draw. Tell me a little bit about tribal gaming and your first job, and what was that like for you?
Well, you know, getting into tribal gaming, as you've heard so far, I spent, you know, a predominant part of my life in either as an owner or in Nevada in corporate gaming. And so when an opportunity in tribal gaming came along, you know, there were a lot of people that I knew in the industry who were saying, don't go there. It's not necessarily stable. It can be very political and, you know, you need to stay in corporate gaming. And I remember in my own mind thinking, sort of chuckling, saying, really? Corporate gaming is the most political environment I've ever been in, right? But the old joke in Vegas is, it's not what you know, it's who you know. But so I ended up getting an opportunity with the Southern Ute Tribe in the Four Corners of Colorado. And it was an incredible experience. The Southern Ute Tribe is, you know, amazing to work for. They have incredible business acumen. At the time, they were the richest tribe in the country. And, you know, for me, the transition was easy. I spent 7 years with them and helped them design, develop, and build and finance the Sky Ute Casino. It was about a $200 million project. And we went out to the bond market, and, you know, their credit's so good. We're the only casino that I know of in the nation at the time that had a AAA bond rating, and still is AAA. Yeah. So, and ensuing tribes that I've worked for, same scenario. They incredible to work for, highly professional. The San Carlos Apache tribe, they have almost 19,000 members. They greatly diversified, multiple businesses. Really, really amazing what they're doing. And man, what a great tribe to work for. I'm proud to and blessed to be able to work for them.
Great project. Yeah, really, really cool. Matt, tell me what it takes to be a great CEO and maintain that over years.
Well, you know, that that's the recipe. You know, I think, first of all, what it takes, you got to have passion for the business. I mean, you just got to love what you're doing. If you don't love what you're doing, go find something else to do. In fact, the chairman here at San Carlos Tribe and I talk all the time. We text all the time, and we talk about, you know, he sent me a text the other day that said, well, I'm 25-8 like the rest of us, you know. So you got to be passionate, and it just never stops. You don't put your phone down, whether, you know, communicating, whether it's, you know, 2 a.m. or noon. But then, you know, it takes just dedication, as much experience as you can possibly get, you know, just in all aspects of the business, you know, focus, drive, hard work, commitment to leadership, and I think also a real commitment to professional growth and development.
Yeah, that's really the and the team, right?
Well, so that's the next step, right? So there's that, but then you really, you know, as a leader, you've got a team, and of course your team includes your executive team and the people you get around you, and getting, you know, the best and the brightest that you can around you and challenging them. But also, again, and this sort of goes back to the earlier part of the conversation about, you know, developing the organization as a team, meaning, you know, you've got to empower your team members and the people out there every day, those line level people who are working so hard and interacting with your guests and making sure that you're, you know, communicating with them, holding regular meetings with your team members, and, you know, working collaboratively, getting the executive team involved, making decisions as a group. So, you know, you're really only going to, at the end of the day, you're only as good as the team that, you know, frankly, you're blessed to work with. And so you've got to have a commitment to them to keep them involved and engaged and hearing what they have to say and, you know, spending time with, you know, line level team members and having regular meetings with, you know, not only line level, but executive team members in a very collaborative environment where, you know, no decision, no critical decision for the organization goes without input from everybody. And frankly, I love dissension. I don't like when everybody agrees on anything. So I like team members who are going to step up and tell me I'm wrong.
What is your advice to younger people coming up into the business?
You know, I would say you've got to be hungry to learn. I mean, you've really got to be hungry to take on this industry, and you've got to work hard. You've got to challenge yourself. Don't be afraid to take on new challenges. Don't get too stuck in one position. Get out and try different things. And then, you know, don't be afraid to get in front of your boss and show them, you know, what your ideas are and how you can exceed and excel in certain areas. And then, as with everything, you know, if you really want to stay ahead of things, if you're young and you want to move up, stay be forward thinking. I mean, if we all think today that the gaming industry is, you know, just brick and mortar and slot machines, anybody who thinks that, the industry already left them behind. I mean, the future of this industry is you know, no longer that to a large degree. It's things that we're only just now thinking of, like mobile gaming and application-based gaming and mobile sports. And the big thing now, as we all know, is competitive esports. So, you know, if you're young and you're getting into the industry, stay a step ahead. Don't think that where it is today is where it will be 5 years from now.
What do you think of all the proliferation of gaming that's happened especially within the last 5 years? And how is that going to affect our industry? Are we looking at a bubble? Because if you look at the numbers of casinos and the amount of money that's been spent on expansions that is still being spent, is it too excessive?
You know, I think that brick and mortar gaming still has a place and, you know, certainly opportunities in certain markets to continue to expand, particularly in major metro markets. But my personal opinion is the gaming industry is evolving like all other industries evolve. And I think we all know that in this industry, brick and mortar gaming has really been, again, primarily that of the baby boomer generation. But we're coming into an age where Gen Xers and millennials, that's just not their thing. They don't really do the, you know, let's go into the casino and pull a handle on a slot machine. I mean, now, you know, I mean, many of them will, and some, you know, larger metro casinos are kind of reinventing things like, you know, doing the Saturday night bingo parties and things like that. But the industry's at risk. And as it is today, it's going to have to reinvent itself. And I think that probably comes down to just some of the things we just talked about that, I don't think brick and mortar will ever go away. I think it's going to have to look towards things that will attract the next few generations, which, again, could be, well, we certainly know it's mobile gaming. That's a huge industry. Within the casinos, we certainly know it might be micro-tracking gaming, application-based gaming, and fantasy sports is still huge. And of course now competitive esports. And so the industry's got some work ahead of it. If we think we're just going to settle in and just keep expanding existing casinos, I don't think that's where it's at. I mean, Vegas is a great lesson where, you know, the strip even today after 2008, from a gaming perspective, is still losing money. So the money they're making is on tourism and hotel rooms and destination travel and food and beverage. They're not making it even now on the gaming floor.
Yeah, it's been a seismic shift, you know, somewhere in the line of 75-25, 75 entertainment, 25% from the gambling, correct?
Right. Yeah, that's right. And I think that's working its way out. You know, as we know in tribal gaming now, there's tribal gaming has just, you know, thanks to IGRA, taken such a massive share of gaming, you know, across the nation. And so for, you know, for tribal gaming, it's not quite the same scenario as the strip, but if we all don't realize that's where we're headed, then we're crazy. So, you know, we in tribal gaming are going to have to come to the realization that the gaming industry is really going to have to reinvent itself to really start looking at the next generations, you know, going forward. And how are we going to attract and appeal to those generations? and how do we change as an industry? So it's an interesting time.
So are we being threatened also by other entertainment, concerts, theaters, movies? And how do we stay ahead of that?
Great point. I mean, at the end of the day, we're all fighting for disposable dollars. And so that's exactly right, that not only are we, you know, threatened by other casinos and other gaming opportunities, most of which now, as we know, are all mobile and online, and many of them, as sadly as we know, are illegal, unfortunately, because the industry hasn't kept up with internet and mobile gaming. So there's a lot of that we're competing with. But yeah, we're competing with all disposable dollars. So we're competing with, you know, going to the ball game. And as we said, one of the biggies is competitive esports. I think we just heard about a young man playing a video game that won $3 million. And so that's a huge industry in and of itself. So, you know, that's something as an industry we always have to realize is the only scraps we get are those of disposable dollars, whether they're going out to dinner or going to play a slot machine.
Yeah, it's all disposable. Is understanding data is what sets you apart from the competitors?
Well, you know, in our current world, I think that our industry's evolved so much that probably, you know, the biggest, where I spend most of my time is in analytics. And what I mean by spending a lot of my time in analytics is, you know, the old-fashioned types of analytics was just sort of combing through your active player database and sending out, you know, offers as a, you know, percentage of reinvestment and not really diving deep into understanding the data the power of the data that you have in what you do, particularly, yes, in your active player database, but also, you know, through other resources. But so to me, I have begun to focus a huge amount of my time on higher level analytics and marrying the different types of analytics between financial analysis, slot analytics, and marketing analytics in a way that you can really drill down into the active player database and be most effective in things like, let's take market segmentation modeling. Most casinos have these crazy models about how they segment their different markets in the active player database for reinvestment purposes. They'll do things like $25 at a time or whatever. We've gotten, you know, we're at a point where we're much more advanced and we're using algorithms to really define the segmentation modelings from a marketing perspective to put the highest density of population in each segment closest to the mean. But we also marry that with slot analytics. So starting to really use a lot of pretty high-level algorithms to customer tailor your slot product on your gaming floor in a way that matches the habits, likes, and desires of those active players in your particular market. And, you know, those kind of take some interesting algorithms, too, to just track the habits and behaviors of your gamers as you bring in new machines and involve your gaming floor to really understand what, you know, manufacturer types of games, what denomination types of games, and other components of games that your market, your current gamers tend to migrate to. And so it's gone from sort of some rudimentary low level, you know, we kind of think we understand analytics, to some really very high level algorithms that now more and more can help you put the best gaming product on the floor, get you the best segmentation modeling, and get you at the exact perfect reinvestment rate based on all of that data. Now, beyond that, how do you talk to your uncarded gamers? And now, you know, more and more, we're starting to look at ways where we're able to extract that data from within the casino and from externally, where we can not only start customizing our analytics to our active player database, but we can actually start taking a very close, careful look at our uncarded gamers. And so that's some kind of breakthrough stuff that we're really having a lot of success with.
That's great stuff. This has been fantastic. Should we take some calls?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, great. Hello, this is Tino Magnetta. Do you have a question for Matt?
Evening, guys. Nick Boston here. How's it going, Matt?
Great. How about you?
Great, great. You definitely have a unique background. I don't know anybody who started off as an investor and became an operator. That's definitely unique.
I started at the other end of the spectrum, didn't I?
You did. Normally, it's the exact opposite. I won't take much time because you have a fantastic outline of your experience and your career. One question I had is, what are some rules that you have when you're looking at building a new property?
Wow, all good. That's actually a great question for such a very short, simple one. So, obviously the first rule of thumb when you're building a new property, and I've had the good or bad fortune, depending on how you look at it, at designing, developing, financing, building, and opening 7 new casinos over my career. So I've certainly learned through experience. Of course, it goes without saying that the first rule is that you have to have a feasibility study that you have belief in and you can rely on, you know, obviously based on gravity modeling and what the true potential market for whatever facility is that you're going to build. And I got to be candid with you. There's a lot of great folks out there who do that. I won't name names. And there's a lot who aren't so great. And so when you get a good feasibility study, go get a sanity check and get another one. So that's the first part, because the key is you want to design and develop a property in the right market that fits the market. And so many times people way overbuild their facilities. And that's a giant problem. And I've seen it countless times that the feasibility studies were unreliable, or the operators wanted to go way beyond what would be a reasonable scope in terms of building that facility. So that's the first part, understanding your market, understanding what the potential for the market is, understanding what the correct amenities are for that market. That should all be part of the research and the development of what the facility is going to look at. And then from there you get into all kinds of real specific things that you have to evaluate from a development perspective, which includes not the least of which is site and location, access, and then beyond that, there's all kinds of things where people make terrible mistakes, including not understanding, you know, the environment in which they're building and developing and constructing a casino. But I hope I answered your question, but I think the bottom line is it really comes down to you've got to start with the right model. You've got to really know your market. You've got to be very careful not to overbuild And if anything, build in phases.
No, that was great. Selfishly, I've focused on the construction side, the maintaining of the build versus the cost of construction, because you spend extra money on building a hotel room a certain way or a floor the certain way, and it takes longer to clean it and more money to maintain over time. Your capital expense is actually eaten up over a period of time if you haven't thought about how you're going to maintain that building once it's open.
You know, that's a great point too, and I didn't really get into that, but you know, you've got a really good point in terms of ergonomics and efficiency of the facility, and you know, focusing on the actual construction component of it and the design of the building, in terms of, you know, efficiencies of operation, and even also during development, just, you know, how you can, you know, more effectively value engineer and efficiently build it. And there's even things like the last facility that I was involved in opening, where simple mistakes were made as part of the construction, where they didn't do a geotech before they started moving dirt, and they failed to do a hydrological study, and it ended up in a nightmare in terms of site development and access to water. So, but I really like your approach of, okay, once you've made the decision to build, how are you going to design that facility in a way that's, you know, really ergonomic, that can really minimize operational costs and maximize, you know, revenue. And so that's interesting you point that out.
No, great.
Great.
Absolutely. Thank you for entertaining me. I'm not sure you want to talk about that, but I was happy to hear you to do it. Thank you.
Great answer. Great question. Thanks, Nick. Appreciate it. Have a good night. Great questions. All right. Let's go to the next one here. Hello, this is Tino Magnetta. Do you have a question for Matt?
Aloha, Matt. Aloha, Tino. This is Michael Ka. Hanui, how are you today?
Great. Aloha.
Aloha.
Very good. Aloha.
You got some.
Are you calling from Hawaii today?
Yeah, not today, unfortunately. I'm calling from the great state of Ohio today, but I am from Hawaii. So, Matt, you've gotten some great points. You know, one of the things, you know, you get a guy with your kind of background. What was the first thing that you kind of realized once you transitioned into operations that you realized that they weren't BSing you in terms of to an investor, right? You're like, wow, they really meant what they said the first time I've made that transition and understand those challenges.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because, you know, as you know, before I wasn't an operator, I was an investor, and that's how I opened casinos. And when was that point that I realized it? I came to the realization that the folks that were pitching the development and the operators were fairly substantially overstating the potential upside of the operation and understating the challenges and the risks involved in you know, keeping the operation profitable and successful, and you know, what the potential downsides were to the investments. And I learned that, you know, early in the 90s when my partners and I opened casinos, and the partners were the experts. And when we first opened, you know, everything that they said, you know, worked well. I mean, the facility just, we were printing money. It was doing so well. But they way underestimated the challenges that were coming, the competitive nature of the environment, you know, the operational challenges that we were going to be facing. And so we ended up going through a period of time where a lot of people don't realize that casinos can lose money, but let me tell you what, they can lose money. So we, as an investor, I was writing checks, you know, keep the doors open for many, many months, until I finally ended up having to take over operations. And so I hope I'm answering your question, but as an investor in the gaming industry, it's easy to get pulled into the operators and people who are and developers who, number one, don't understand their challenges, and number two, overstate, really greatly overstate the potential upside to what you're getting yourself into.
No, I think you hit the nail on the head there. Certainly just kind of seeing that realization, you know, they're always trying to sell the sizzle, not necessarily the steak for, you know, for getting that investment money. But I think it's fantastic that, you know, you got that trust. So obviously being an operator now probably makes you a better investor. And I think one of the things as a CEO, you're probably looking to invest time into your, in your biggest resources, which is your team members. So how do you identify, you know, your high potential team members, and what do you do to kind of really develop them?
Yeah, that's a really good question too. I love to develop what I call KPIs, and I like to develop recognition or reward programs that are based on key performance indicators at all levels, line level employees. So when I have employees who excel, when they're performing, I want to make it measurable. I want to understand it. I want to be able to recognize and identify sort of rock stars within the organization. And I also develop what I call career development programs, so that when we have individuals who are committed and devoted and out there and performing, that number one, we have ways to understand that. And we do, in my view, my feeling in management is if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. So I look for ways to identify when team members, managers, directors, whomever they are really excelling. You know, how do I see that and how do I identify it? And in almost every organization I've been in, I develop a bonus program and a recognition program based on a balanced scorecard that uses those key performance indicators, and really, as a result, recognizes the, you know, the focused, hardworking, dedicated team members, and gives them those types of rewards. But then also couples that with a career development program that helps get them on a new career track where they actually can meet with a career development counselor, and we can find ways to move them, you know, into the next levels. We do that for tribal members, but we also do it for non-tribal members, including paying for education, and other types of things that we can help them kind of advance their careers and you know, bring them to the top. One of the things I always say to my managers and directors is, who do you spend most of your time with? Your top performers or your weakest team members? And not that we don't already know the answer to that. They spend 90% of their time with their weakest team members, and they ignore their top performers. And, you know, so what I try to impress upon them is reverse that model. Don't waste your time on your weakest team members. Spend time with them, try to develop them, coach them, mentor them, but at some point move on and focus on your top performers. That's where your future is, and that's where their future is. And that's one of management's weakest problems. They just spend their time in the weeds dealing with difficult employees.
Yeah, good point.
That's just such a waste of time.
Statement.
You know, and good points. Hey, just one more. You know, as an investor, obviously, I think, you know, it comes down and as a business operator, hey, it's all about those margins, right? How do you now, as you've moved around, and you've probably seen the different margins that different properties operate at, how do you go for that, you know, that efficiency model where you're going to get the best you can for that particular property in terms of margins?
Cool question. So, number one, I love your point. It's all in the margins. So, when I put together performance measurement matrix and KPIs, I use common size statements. I do not use financial statements. And I'm sure everybody knows that common size are margin statements. And because most organizations have limited control over the actual dollar size of revenues from time to time and season to season. They have some, but it's limited. But what they do have control over are the margins. And so everything that I reward and recognize is based in the margins, in common size statements, and I benchmark. And there's a lot of tools out there to benchmark. So believe me, I'm not trying to plug, but I'll only plug it because it's one of the better tools, if it's all right to do this. I use the Joseph Eve cost of doing business annual statements because they benchmark industry to industry. And so I challenge my organization to meet and exceed industry benchmarks based on the margins, based on common size statements from the Eve report. And I actually have graphs and reports where I can, you know, dollar for dollar match our expenses, our labor margins, our cost of goods sold margins, our operational efficiencies, you know, even some pretty high level data in terms of, you know, time on device, you know, dollar value and size of active player databases and different things like that. But in terms, as an investor, in terms of deliveries to you, if I'm the operator and you're the investor, I better benchmark and I better be able to prove that we're at or better than industry standard.
You know, that's fantastic.
Great stuff.
I think you're really hitting all the key focuses there. You know, it was a pleasure to talk to you, sir, and hopefully one day I'll get to meet you here at a G2E or something. So good luck to you, continued success, and you guys have a good night.
Yeah, you
Thank
too.
You so much. Thanks
question.
For calling in.
Yeah, aloha.
Aloha. Matt, that's
yeah,
been
aloha.
Fantastic.
By the way, I used to own a condo on the Big Island.
Oh, really? Yeah, I like the Big Island. Whereabouts? Kona or...
You know what? I had a condo on Waikoloa on the golf course there. I bought it in 99 and sold it in 2005. So,
wow.
Missed doing that.
I like the Big Island. I like the Big Island.
Yeah,
Big Island's cool.
My favorite island.
Yeah, yeah. There's that that town that The Rock is from, Dwayne Johnson, Hilo.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
where
yeah,
there's no tourism, it's all Hawaiian up there. It's pretty cool. Matt, we've run out of time. It's been a great interview. I really appreciate you coming on the show, and I'm looking forward for you to come back on. You said some incredible stuff. We've gotten some incredible feedback, and thanks for coming on tonight.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. You have a good night, and continued success to you.
Yep, you as well. Thank you.
Thanks, buddy. Bye-bye. That was great. Matt has some amazing insight, especially because he started as a casino owner and then transitioned into a casino operator. So September 16th, I have Jeff Martinelli from the D. That's Monday, September 16th. And it's going to be fantastic. Great speaker. Wait to hear his stories. Really, really cool and funny. Remember, everybody's got a story to tell. You just have to have time to listen. You all have a good evening, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye.